120 and 150 tablets and received between 8 and 10 injections every week. The tide had turned once and for all against Giesing, who was given a check from Bormann for 10,000 Reichsmarks in compensation for his work. Both Hasselbach and the influential Brandt were out of luck as well, also damaging the latter's confidant, Speer, who had his eye on Hitler's succession. The three doctors had to leave headquarters. Morell was the only one who stayed behind. On October 8, 1944, he rejoiced in the happy news. "The Führer told me that Brandt had only to meet his obligations in Berlin." Patient A stood firmly by his supplier. Just as every addict adores his dealer, Hitler was unable to leave the generous doctor who provided him with everything he needed. The dictator told his physician, "These idiots didn't even think about what they were doing to me. I would suddenly have been standing there without a doctor, and these people should have known that during the 8 years you have been with me, you have saved my life several times. And how I was before. All doctors who were dragged in failed. I'm not an ungrateful person, my dear doctor. If we are both lucky enough to make it through the war, then you'll see how well I will reward you." Morell's confident reply can also be read as an attempt to justify himself to posterity, because the physician put it baldly on record, "My Führer, if a normal doctor had treated you during that time, then you would have been taken away from your work for so long that the Reich would have perished." According to Morell's own account, Hitler peered at him with a long, grateful gaze and shook his hand. "My dear doctor, I am glad and happy that I have you." The war between the doctors was thus shelved. Patient A had put a stop to a premature dismissal. The price he paid was the continued destruction of his health by a personal physician who had been confirmed in his post. To calm his nerves, the head of state received Eucadol, Eupavirine, Glucose IV plus Homoceran IM. Self-obliteration. Life in headquarters is now such that one can write little about it, as the conditions are more or less all internal in nature. I look forward to being able to tell you that the Führer is fit and well, and concerned day and night with how he can improve and master the fate of Germany. I am still very close to the front in the East. From a letter from Theodor Morell. Just like the potent substances in Hitler's blood supply, his existence itself, which had seemed solid for so long, dissolved gradually into nirvana. This is a development worth following if we are both to understand how the formerly energetic Führer was transformed into a human ruin, and to gauge how this process interacted with historical events. In the last quarter of 1944, while the fronts closed in on all sides, the vice tightened, intestinal cramps intensified, and Hitler managed to survive his little remaining time by taking strong narcotics and erecting a pharmacological barricade around himself. The deluded totalitarian system that he himself had created did not allow for a sober Führer. Since he was convinced that he alone could realize all the ambitious goals of National Socialism during his own lifetime and did not trust any potential successor to establish the German World Reich, he could under no circumstances give up. With Morell's drugs, he could keep going and maintain his tunnel vision. Under no circumstances did Hitler want to come down from his megalomaniac Führer trip, in spite of the disastrous military situation. He refused to come to his senses. If so, he would be obliged to notice the vanity, the madness of the whole enterprise. In complete denial, he couldn't allow himself to doubt his battle, waged against the whole world, or even lose his taste for the war, which he himself had unleashed and already lost long ago. Remorselessly, the needle penetrated his skin, the plunger was pulled back, the stuff shot into the veins, and he escaped again into self-delusion. The fact was that between the autumn of 1941, when he started being given hormone and steroid injections, and the second half of 1944, when first the cocaine, and then above all the Eucadol kicked in, Hitler hardly enjoyed a sober day. This helped him to never break out of his own closed system, never to awaken from the nightmare until the very end. The chasm was definitive and irreparable. As soon as any psychological bridge to reality was tentatively rebuilt, it was immediately blown up by a further pharmacological explosion. Drugs were fuel and a stand-in for a lack of commitment. By now he found that his illusions could be bolstered only by narcotics. He traveled from headquarters to headquarters, from bunker to bunker, from disinhibition to disinhibition, unbounded, homeless, always on his way to the next futile military action, the next fix that would let him repress all consequences while ignoring all possible side effects. He moved in a permanent fog, a doped-up performance athlete unable to stop until the inevitable collapse. The Super Bunker. My dear old friend, I hope I can still call you that, even though you're now an international celebrity. But I know your character. The German people are very grateful to you for your beneficial work, as we would be lost if the strong hand was missing. And that this hand has remained strong until today is your inextinguishable merit. From a letter to Theodor Morell. To better protect himself against future attempts on his life, infections or any other kind of attack, on the afternoon of November 8, 1944, patient A moved into a brand new refuge within the Führer's restricted area at the Wolf's Lair. Instead of the usual 6-foot-thick concrete ceilings, this one had a 23-foot-thick concrete gravel casing. The windowless block didn't have any direct ventilation and looked like an ancient Egyptian tomb. The quantities of material exceeded many times over the usable space that they surrounded. Hitler worked, slept, and vegetated there, in total isolation, locked in his delusion and living off his own substance. He himself could see only positive sides to the new habitation, which seemed to have fallen into the forest like a monstrous foreign body from the sky. The dictator happily stated he now had more room to walk about inside. Morell calculated the Führer's sleeping and working area was 800 cubic feet larger than in the old bunker. Of course, the doctor always had access to the otherwise isolated sarcophagus-like building to inject him intravenously with Eucodol for excessive stress to celebrate the move. Morell had known for a long time the state of his patient and how quickly Hitler was going downhill, or turning in on himself, and how much people were talking about it. Letters that the doctor wrote to his wife, various Gauleiter, and old acquaintances during the late autumn of 1944 expressed the desperate desire to depict reality other than it was. This also included mailing the daily menus from the Wolf's Lair. These were supposed to provide proof to outsiders of Hitler's simple and reasonable way of life. Whereas he had never previously mentioned his patient's health to third parties, he now communicated an ostentatiously good mood to all and sundry. A collection of his lines, "My high-up patient is very well. My most important patient is always very well. An improvement is fully in place. I am glad that my patient's health is in a good state. My patient's health is very good, and I hope I will be able to keep him in his old, fresh state for the German people for a long time to come. Apart from the Duce, I have in fact been able to heal several other heads of state and can actually be very contented with the success of my medical efficacy." But patient A was not at all well. In fact, Morell could only simulate, stage manage, inject back into shape a healthy Hitler for increasingly shorter intervals. Often Hitler lay pale and haggard on a simple field bed in his new concrete residence, in his white nightshirt, under a military blanket. An adjustable lamp was suspended over his head. A bedside table and a low rack were packed to the brim with sheets of paper, situation maps, open books, and urgent reports. In the midst of this chaos was a telephone that never rang. The light gray walls gave off the bleak smell of unset concrete. The bed was scattered with broken pencils. Lost somewhere among the mess were nickel-framed glasses he was ashamed of because he could no longer put them on by himself due to the extreme tremors in his hands. Nonetheless, Morell wrote, "I can report that the F is full of beans. It is my greatest joy, reassurance, and satisfaction that my patient is very well, and that with his vigor and freshness he is a match for any task and could master any crisis. It may be of some comfort to you if I can assure you that our Führer is in a good state of health." But as soon as the effect of the Eucadol waned, the trembling began, and in the last few weeks of 1944 only grew in intensity. Soon it came to dominate all discussions of the state of Hitler's health. Aware of this, the Aschenführer tried with all his strength to suppress the shaking, which only made it worse. The saluting arm, held stiffly and tirelessly aloft, was now a thing of the past. Nervous, violent vibrations of all his extremities had taken over. "Left hand, very strong tremor," wrote Morel. "Then, increased tremor in the right hand. Or, the left leg is not trembling now, but the left arm and the left hand are." Hitler buried his fingers in his coat pockets to conceal the fact. By now it could hardly have been described as trembling, as it had graduated to shaking. His entourage was seriously alarmed. Panzer General Heinz Guderian, now head of the Army General Staff, reported that Hitler had to put his right hand on his left and his right leg over his left leg to make the shaking less visible when he was sitting down. Hitler's hand vibrated, oscillated, and maneuvered of its own free will so much that many people thought it was intentional. If he folded his arms in front of his chest, his whole torso was set in motion. Morel recommended baths and rest. Hitler asked if he couldn't be given injections for it. But injections wouldn't alleviate the problem, quite the contrary. In search of the cause for his trembling limbs and stooped posture, medical historians have diagnosed the dictator as suffering from arteriosclerotic Parkinson's disease, a shaking palsy probably provoked by an autoimmune disorder. With Parkinson's, the body's neurons are mistaken for foreign bodies by the immune system and attacked, the possible result of his having consumed outrageous preparations made of animal hormones. The consequences are that dopamine-producing nerve cells wither, and there is a lack of nourishment to the essential nuclei of the cerebral cortex, which is responsible for learning and control processes. In his notes, Morel also expressed a suspicion of Parkinson's, although not until April 1945. There is no way of telling whether the diagnosis is accurate. Another, perhaps supplementary, explanation is that Hitler's notorious shaking was the direct effect of his unchecked drug consumption. At any rate, Morel was not allowed to leave his patient alone during this phase. On the one hand, the physician was now leading his leader, but on the other, he had become his prisoner. "No one could imagine the grief this position caused him," he complained. "For years he hadn't been able to move far from Hitler. He hadn't been his own master for a long time, and he was forced to neglect everything in his own life, his beloved wife, his practice on the Kurfürstendamm, the factories and research laboratories in Olmütz and Hamburg. Even when his brother died, Morel was not given permission to go to the funeral, as he had become indispensable." Hitler swiftly countered each of his suggestions. "After I informed him of the death of my brother, the F was very concerned about my trip, as the West was in severe danger. I suggested a plane. This was out of the question, as there were always large numbers of hostile fighter planes in the skies. Car? I wouldn't be able to bear such a long journey in spite of my reassurances to the contrary. Railways can only be used conditionally due to air raids." Hitler flatly refused the locum suggested by Morel for the brief period of his absence. He suspected that the SS Dr. Ludwig Stumpfegger might not give such good injections, or might the reason have been that Stumpfegger didn't know the secret of X? Morel insisted on retaining one last scrap of his own private family life. Despite all attempts to keep him in the wolf's lair, he did travel to his brother's funeral, and on the way back called in briefly on his wife in Berlin. Hitler gave him a bodyguard from the Reich Security Service, and became more indignant than ever after the return of his doctor. 3:30 p.m., with the Führer, patient unfriendly, no questions, major rebuff. Morel quickly got his needles out, took a deep breath, wiped the pearls of sweat from his forehead, and stuck the point of the platinum needle into his patient's forearm. Glucose IV plus Vitamaltin Forte, Glyconorm, Tonophosphan. Hitler put his left hand on his belt buckle and breathed out noisily, hunched his shoulders, and pursed his thin, pinched lips, which made his mouth look even smaller. Then his face relaxed, and Morel skillfully massaged the swallowed air up from Hitler's belly. They were already back on the same wavelength. Track marks. While the Red Army was taking more and more towns in East Prussia in November 1944, Hitler's veins were so wrecked that even the expert shotgiver Morel could hardly penetrate them. The skin of the veins, perforated too many times, was inflamed, scarred, and a peculiar shade of brown. Morel had to take a break. I canceled injections today to give the previous puncture holes a chance to heal. Left inside elbow good, right still has red dots, but not pustules, where injections were given. F says this wasn't the case before. It actually made a crunching noise every time Morel gave him a shot. Each jab created a new wound that joined the previous one, and it produced an elongated, growing crust, what junkies call track marks, when one jab is followed by the next to form an unlovely line. Even Hitler was gradually becoming nervous and worrying about what the huge number of injections was doing to him. When I gave him the intravenous injection, the Führer thought I wasn't rubbing the area long enough with alcohol, so that he often developed small red pustules at the needle holes. But Morel had another explanation for the condition. Blood low in oxygen, from months sitting in the bunker with no daylight or fresh air, and venous, as becomes apparent when applying a tourniquet, and consequently not sufficiently coagulable, and the needle hole staying red. Hitler remained suspicious. Führer still attributes this to bacteria, and thinks bacteria might be entering his body with the injections. Out of necessity, Morel wanted to stop the orgy of shots for a while. But in the end, Hitler swept all qualms aside, and his auto-aggressive qualities came to the fore. In spite of the unpleasantness that the countless injections caused him, he didn't stop demanding them. And when receiving his doctor, the first thing he said was that he didn't need treatment, but that he did need an injection. 6 o'clock in the morning. I am to go to the patient immediately. There in 20 minutes. Führer had worked through the night and had a very momentous decision to make, which had left him deeply irritable. The anxiety had become increasingly powerful until at last, quite suddenly, as always when he became very agitated, a convulsion had set in. He didn't want an examination, as that only intensified the pain. I quickly prepared a combined injection of eupavirine and eucadol, and administered it intravenously, which was very difficult given the many recent inoculations. But in the process I observed that we must spare the veins for a while. As I had to pause before giving him the injection, relaxation took place during the injection, and the pain was gone. The F was very happy about it, and gratefully shook my hand. 20 minutes between phone call and application. Most addicts can only dream of having such a dealer. Hitler valued his doctor's constant availability, and on October 31, 1944, he praised him, saying that the rapid intervention yesterday morning had led to a complete recovery. Morel replied reassuringly if such a state should recur, he was to call straight away even if it was the middle of the night. It would give me the greatest pleasure to be able to help him. Often during those last weeks in the wolf's lair, patient A made use of his 24-hour room service for even the hardest substances, and called Morel out even after midnight, shamelessly citing all kinds of tiny aches and pains or nervous strains. While an orderly brought the doctor's bag back to the drone barracks, the doctor waited by his patient until the effects took hold. On November 8, 1944, when the high wasn't strong enough, Morel generously added a little extra. Wednesday, 00:30, suddenly awoken. All of a sudden, the Führer has severe gas distension in his body. As he told me, at the moment he has to make the biggest decisions of his life, and this is putting an ever greater strain on his nerves. Intravenous eucadol, eupavirine, initially eases the pain, and the convulsions only partially. In response to his request for another half injection, I have the bag brought back, and see that I have injected only 0.01 eucadol intravenously instead of 0.02. After another injection of 0.01 eucadol intravenously, the pains and the spasm immediately start to ease. The Führer thanked me effusively for this immediate assistance and was then completely happy. An addict notices immediately when he hasn't been given the full batch. An addict knows nothing but the longing for the next, completely satisfying shot. Every other aspect of existence disappears into the background, regardless of whether it is daytime or the middle of the night. In this period after the attempt on his life, when Hitler's drug consumption reached record levels, the dictator finally lost his biochemical balance and his health. Stauffenberg hadn't killed him, but he had indirectly turned him into a drug addict. Hitler was degenerating. His face turned ochre, his eyelids sagged. The shaking of his limbs was getting worse and worse, and his concentration was clearly declining. Under Allied questioning after the war, Hitler's second surgeon, Hans Karl von Hasselbach, who referred disparagingly to Morell's treatments as witchcraft, sketched the medical development as follows. Until 1940, Hitler looked much younger than he really was, but after that he had aged rapidly. Until 1943, his outward appearance matched his age, but later his rapid physical decay became obvious. The fact is, Eucadol was first used in 1943, but was injected so often between September and December 1944 that one must consider the possibility of a physical dependency. The happy fix came at a cost of unpleasant side effects, insomnia, tremors, and constipation. Hitler suffered from all of them. As soon as the high began to ebb, his digestive tract reacted with spastic obstipation, severe constipation, and he had no evacuation, painful wind. At night he lay in bed with his eyes open. "Then I can't go to sleep. In the dark I keep seeing the general staff maps in front of me, and my brain goes on working, and it takes hours before I can break free." He claimed the only reason he couldn't get to sleep was the British bombers flying over the Reich territory, but it was probably the drugs that were keeping him awake. To give him the rest he needed, Morell had to administer barbiturate-based narcotics like Luminol or Quadronox. The cycle continued. Probably as a consequence of the frequent Eucadol shots, Hitler's digestion barely worked now, and as far as his intestinal complaints were concerned, he had reached the spot where Morell had started treating him with Mutaflor in 1936. Because of patient A's chronic constipation, he had to take chamomile suppositories, which provoked him to the toilet. I had to stay outside. He even locked the door, but it did no good. The fluid didn't stay inside. He immediately had to push it out again, unfortunately. Führer is supposed to try to sleep without medication. The simplest bodily functions grew into strenuous physiological operations, which were recorded as conscientiously as if they were events at the front, as described in the Wehrmacht Oberkommando's war diary. From 4 until 6, 4 evacuations, 2 of which were weaker and 2 very strong. At the second, after the passing of an obstruction, explosive water evacuation. The third and fourth were very foul-smelling, and particularly the fourth, probably a decomposing agglomeration that had previously been left behind and had become a cause of gases and the formation of toxic substances. Relatively improved condition and change of facial expression. He only called me to impart to me the happy news of the effect. The question of guilt. On November 21st, 1944, lunch was rice gruel and fried celery slices with mashed potato, after which the Wolf's Lair closed. Hitler had been in his new superbunker for less than a fortnight, but the Russians were too close and headquarters had to be evacuated. With windows tinted to hide the landscape of bomb damage and too much reality, a carriage rattled off toward the Reich capital. It was the Führer's special train, Brandenburg, and the stations it passed had been cleared of people. As Hitler saw no chance of prevailing against Stalin's Red Army, he had given up on the East. As an alternative, he was planning his second Ardennes offensive, dreamed up in September on cocaine, perhaps trying to repeat the Blitzkrieg miracle of the spring of 1940, or at least to change tack in the West so as to obtain a negotiated peace there at the last minute. The arrival in Berlin-Grunewald was at 5:20 in the morning, under conditions of strictest secrecy. The shorthand secretary recorded, "Confidential, keep silent." Hitler, who was concerned about losing his voice because of a nodule on his vocal cords, spoke only in a whisper anyhow. His eyes were no longer focused on his surroundings, and stared instead at imaginary points. Again and again he greedily sucked oxygen from a little portable army oxygen device that Morel had acquired for the journey. Seldom had Hitler's mood been darker or grimmer. Everyone knew. The plan to repel the huge forces of the Americans and the British was illusionary, but the Supreme Commander continued as if he were certain of victory. In truth, he was so badly affected by the great agitation caused by his distended stomach and seizures that only Eukaidol could help. A day later, he also received 10 milligrams of morphine. 2 days later, on November 24, 1944, Morel recorded, "I didn't think injection was necessary, but Führer wants to have some for faster recovery." Again, 3 days later, "The Führer wants to have injections because of imminent hard work." But what effect was this uncontrolled consumption of multiple drugs having on Hitler's intellect, on his mind? Was the dictator still compos mentis? The philosopher Walter Benjamin, who had experimented mainly with hashish but also with Eukaidol a decade previously, orally, which considerably diminishes its addictive potential, described the psychological effect of being permanently intoxicated. "It is perhaps no self-deception if I say that in this state you develop an aversion to the open air, the, so to speak, Uranian atmosphere, and that the thought of the outside becomes almost a torture. It is a dense spider's web in which the events of the world are scattered around, suspended there like the bodies of dead insects sucked dry. You have no wish to leave this cave. Here, furthermore, the rudiments of an unfriendly attitude towards everyone present begin to take shape, as well as the fear that they might disturb you, drag you out into the open." The chemist and author Hermann Rump wrote that long-term abuse of opiates causes damage to the character and the will. Intellectual creativity is impaired, although there is no actual loss of earlier intellectual possession. Even the most upstanding characters will not balk at swindling and deceit. Paranoia and morbid mistrust of one's immediate surroundings also arise. In fact, Hitler's bunker mentality had discovered in Eukaidol the ideal end-time drug for the hapless final battle. His numbness, his rigid view of the world, his tendency toward the fantastical and the unscrupulous transgression of all boundaries, all of this was ominously supported by the opioid that he used so frequently in the last quarter of 1944. During this time, when the Allies were entering the Reich from both east and west, the powerful narcotic erased any doubts about victory, any empathy for civilian victims, and made Hitler even more unfeeling about both himself and the outside world. On this tranquilizing painkiller, the Führer was fully in command of himself. This was the true Hitler, and that was how he had always been. The overestimation of his own significance and misjudgment of his opponents were both captured in his blueprint, Mein Kampf, published in 1925. His opioid addiction only cemented an already existing rigidification, a tendency to delegate violence, and contributed to the fact that in the last phase of the war and in the genocide of the Jews, he never once thought of relenting. So the goals and motives, the ideological fantasy world, were not the result of drugs, but established much earlier. Hitler did not murder because he was living in a haze, quite the contrary. He remained sane until the end. His drug use did not impinge on his freedom to make decisions. Hitler was always the master of his senses, and he knew exactly what he was doing. He acted always in an alert and cold-blooded way. Within his system, based from the beginning on intoxication and a flight from reality, he acted systematically and with terrible consistency to the end. He was anything but insane. A classic case of actio libera in causa, he could go on taking as many drugs as he liked to keep himself in a state in which he could commit his crimes. It does not diminish his monstrous guilt. 4. The Wonder Drug, 1944 to 1945. The Evil Wound, How to Heal It, Richard Wagner, Tristan und Isolde. In the second half of 1944, Hitler's soldiers lost on all fronts. Paris fell to the Allies at the end of August. On August 23rd, the Wehrmacht had to move out of Greece and was in retreat across the whole of southern Europe. On September 11th, American troops reached the German border near Trier. Wherever you looked, the blood-drained, exhausted, overpowered Wehrmacht was fighting a losing battle. Now only Pervitin helped soldiers either to keep going or to flee the enemy. One tank commander reported laconically, "We are driving without stopping until we are out of Russia. We swap over every 100 kilometers, gulp down Pervitin, and stop to fill up." Studies show that 2/3 of those who take crystal meth excessively suffer from psychosis after 3 years. Since Pervitin and crystal meth have the same active ingredient, and countless soldiers had been taking it more or less regularly since the invasion of Poland, the Blitzkrieg on France, or the attack on the Soviet Union, we must assume psychotic side effects, as well as the need to keep increasing the dosage to achieve a noticeable effect. It is no wonder that Pervitin fever should have flourished in 1944 as well. A letter from the Temmler Works to the General Commissar of Health and Medicine shows that even a few months before the end of the war, the company requested distribution of the raw materials ephedrine, chloroform, and hydrochloric acid for the production of Pervitin. 4 million tablets were to be pressed from these for armament and war. Because of the British bombings, the laboratories have been transferred to the little half-timbered town of Meisenheim in southwest Germany, to a brewery, in fact, where the two favorite drugs of the wartime Germans were now being manufactured under a single roof, beer and meth. The Luftwaffe didn't stop using performance-enhancing drugs either. An official scientific and medical conference in July 1944 was devoted to that very subject. The Army Medical Service also used Pervitin, namely for transporting the wounded. In November 1944, the senior doctors of the medical trains of Army Group A set up experiments in which they compared the effect of morphine with the effect of a cocktail of morphine and Pervitin. It turned out that even severely wounded patients could be kept in a good state of mind if they were given 2 Pervitin pills as well as an opiate injection. Their spirits improved as their desire to get better was intensified, which made their redeployment all the more likely. But many soldiers didn't want to be redeployed. They were exhausted, run down, and they needed longer and longer periods of recovery. For many, the propaganda slogans about fighting to the last cartridge rang hollow. No more talk of eagerness. The mood was downcast. But there was no letting up. A typical daily order from Field Marshal Gerd von Rundstedt ended with him saying that the hour decreed that they must recklessly advance. One instruction from Supreme Command reads, "Stress and losses are possible. Medical considerations cannot be taken into account. The situation requires all it takes," and this, of course, included chemicals. Ideology had long lost its hold, and the leadership could think of nothing to motivate their soldiers apart from the increasingly shallow-sounding formula of a final victory. So the Wehrmacht decided to develop new preparations that linked so powerfully with receptors in the central nervous system that even soldiers who were as good as dead would pull themselves together trying to mutate into victors on the battlefield. As fanciful as it seems, in parallel with the laborious efforts to develop a miracle weapon amid the heavy losses of this final phase, the search for a miracle drug that would turn the tables by chemical means was now operating at full blast. On-site visit, Medical Academy of the Bundeswehr, Munich. The Bundeswehr, the current German army, bases its medical academy, the contemporary equivalent of the MA, where Ranke had undertaken his Pervitin experiments, in a former SS barracks. Instead of the questionable meth pusher of the Wehrmacht, I find myself talking to a friendly Dr. Volker Hartmann, who is the captain of the Navy Medical Corps. He leads me across the enormous military compound, past a tank emblazoned with a Red Cross insignia and a grounded medical helicopter. "Threat level Alpha," a sign announces. Hartmann is reassuring. "This means everything's okay." In line with this, Hartmann sets out his very personal vision of a future German army, arguing in favor of entirely humanitarian deployments without weapons. "The Germans can't fight properly anymore anyhow. And perhaps they shouldn't. Our strengths lie elsewhere." Hartmann, at any rate, has served almost everywhere, as a ship's doctor on the training bark Gork Folk, on a frigate off the coast of Lebanon, on a supply ship at the Horn of Africa, in Banda Aceh in Indonesia as part of the Bundeswehr's tsunami relief, in Kosovo, and in Afghanistan. In Mazar-e-Sharif, he was commander of the medical task force for the German medical service. When the head of a company requested the upper modafinil for operations against the Taliban, Hartmann refused to issue the prescription. Modafinil is a psychostimulant, and its precise mechanism of action is still unknown. In sport, the substance is forbidden as a doping agent. School pupils and students sometimes use it as a smart drug to increase concentration and performance. I didn't want to be responsible for possibly addicted soldiers, quite apart from the ethical and political significance, he says, explaining his decision. I confiscated it all. The military and drugs is a field Hartmann has been working in for many years. Among other things, he revealed the extraordinary story of the German Navy's attempts to develop a miracle drug during the final phase of the Second World War. He tells me about it when we meet for the second time in Odeonsplatz in Munich, where on November 9, 1923, after a drink-sodden night in the Bürger Braukeller, the Nazis failed in their attempt at putsch. Now it is late September, a mild evening. The offshoots of the Oktoberfest are raging around us. A lot of people in traditional costume, a lot of beery good humor swills about in the air. When Hitler's putsch happened, the Bavarian police stood over there and fired, Hartmann says, pointing at the spot. One of the first Nazis to be fatally wounded had linked arms with Hitler and pulled him to the ground. At the same time, Hitler's bodyguard was peppered with bullets and fell on top of him. More than a dozen were shot dead on the spot, as were four policemen and a bystander. The onlookers charged in all directions. It was total chaos. Hitler picked himself up and fled, barely hurt. Sometimes history is determined by chance. We sit down in the nearby Pfalzer Residenz Weinstube, a wine bar whose facade bears a plaque to the four dead Bavarian policemen, the first victims of the Nazis. Inside, we order a white wine spritzer, which during Oktoberfest, where beer reigns, almost seems heretical. Hartmann gets into his stride. It's a dirty story about the Navy, which likes to present a clean, proper appearance, trying hard to be a model of moral integrity. The Quest for the Miracle Drug. The Real War Will Never Get in the Books. Walt Whitman. In the German Navy, there was a senior officer called Helmut Heyer. In the 1950s, he stood for Parliament on behalf of the conservative Christian Democratic Union. But on March 16, 1944, he still wanted to win the Second World War and was sitting with two colleagues in a meeting room in the coastal city of Kiel. Heyer was a commanding admiral of the so-called small battle units, the Kaverbande, and directly answerable to the naval supreme commander, Karl Dönitz, who for a few days would become Hitler's successor in early May 1945. The situation at sea wasn't promising for the Imperial Navy, as it chose to call itself in contrast with the National Socialist Luftwaffe. The battle in the Atlantic was lost. The British had cracked the radio code that the Germans assumed was unbreakable. Because of Allied air superiority and the resulting heavy losses, not to mention bad planning in the armaments industry, the U-boat war had to be suspended. Since then, the Allies had been bringing in supplies from America to Britain and preparing for the invasion of Normandy. That was precisely what Heyer wanted to prevent with his new units in the spring of 1944. Hitler hailed the small battle units as a real chance to stop the Allied landings. If I've got them, I can resist the invasion. Even during an arms conference in early January 1944 at the Wolf's Lair, in the presence of the arms minister, Albert Speer, and the head of the SS, Heinrich Himmler, as well as several field marshals, Hitler had demanded the accelerated production of the supposed miracle weapons in which he put so much hope. These were new kinds of two-man U-boats, midget submarines, and one-man torpedoes. The huge enemy superiority was to be nullified by the tactic of launching numerous small attacks. It was David versus Goliath, albeit less biblical. The Kaiva Banda were seen as the new celebrity units of the Navy. Their special operations would be based on surprise effects, on their not being discovered or located. The supposed aim was to creep up to the big enemy ships, ready the torpedo, and attack. Therefore, they would have to spend several days and nights uninterruptedly underwater, distinctly longer than the 48 hours for which a high dose of Pervitin would have kept them awake. No special naval training was planned for these life-threatening operations. Instead, there would be special drugs that far surpassed everything that had gone before. If there was ever a time in this war when perseverance was necessary, this was it. In the spring of 1944, Haya frantically tried to find a quickly available medication that will keep soldiers who are on solo operations for longer than usual and for those who are not in a position to sleep awake and ready for deployment. The drug was also supposed to boost the soldier's confidence and mobilize his reserves of strength. But who could develop such a substance? In civilian life, Professor Dr. Gerhard Orzechowski, naval staff surgeon and head pharmacologist of the Naval Supreme Command on the Baltic, was a professor of pharmacology at Kiel University. During the German occupation of France, he worked in the Naval Medical Research Institute for U-Boat Medicine in Carnac in Brittany, where he had studied performance-enhancing substances. The bespectacled scientist seemed like the right man for the experiment of squeezing the last residues out of the battle-weary troops, pepping up the mini-sub fighters, and forcing through the final victory by means of pharmacology. Orzechowski's explicit goal was to use chemicals to make man a beast of prey. Such an approach suited Haya, since he wanted to deploy the one-man fighting boat known as a Neger, Negro, a play on the name of its inventor, Richard Moore, i.e. Moore. It was shaped like two torpedoes, one on top of the other, the lower one being the weapon itself. In the upper part were the control seat and the pilot's cockpit, protected by a watertight plexiglass dome, a ride on the bomb. Through a simple iron sights visor, the combination of carrier torpedo and live torpedo could be aimed at a target. With good vision, the pilot launched the weapon by foot pedal. Then he had to speed back to the safety of the harbor, an uncertain endeavor given the U.S. fighter bombers' target shooting at those plexiglass domes poking out of the water. For these kamikaze commandos, Orzechowski suggested 10 different preparations under the abbreviations D1 to D10, Drug 1 to Drug 10. They consisted of different quantities of eucodol, cocaine, pervitin, and dicodid, a semi-synthetic morphine derivative similar to codeine, but considerably more potent. Those were the strongest known substances in the world, thrown together at random, a sign of how lax the Navy had become in its treatment of drugs, and of how desperate the situation was. On March 17, 1944, the pharmacy of the Navy Hospital in Kiel produced 5 tablets of each of the 10 creations. A day later, 50 soldiers from the Blaukoppel training camp ingested them. Everything had to be done quickly, and serious tests of the complex interactions of the individual ingredients didn't occur for reasons of time. D9 was the front-runner, a mixture of 5 milligrams of eucodol, 5 milligrams of cocaine, and 3 milligrams of methamphetamine, a brutal combination that might even have been to Hitler's taste. The medical head of the Navy, Admiral Staff Surgeon Dr. Emil Gruhl, had to rubber stamp D9, as cocaine in its powder form was banned from prescription. Haya also gave the project a green light. The medical service quickly prepared 500 tablets for the Beaver, a mini U-boat with 2 torpedoes, as well as for the Neger. In spite of extreme secrecy, the search for the wonder drug was being talked about, especially among the SS. They too were increasingly reliant on special commandos and interested in new discoveries. A collaboration was on its way, one that the Navy later wanted to forget. The notoriously unscrupulous Obersturmbannführer Otto Skorzeny, head of SS secret operations and known to the Western services, who overestimated his actual abilities, as the most dangerous man in Europe, came to Haya's headquarters on March 30, 1944. Since his involvement in the abduction of the arrested Mussolini in September 1943, both Hitler and Himmler supported him in all his undercover operations. Officially, the man with a striking scar on his face only wanted to see the small battle unit's new weapons, but Skorzeny, who had never made a secret of his hard drug use, had come chiefly because of Orzechowski's promising D9. He immediately took charge of 1,000 tablets to test them on a special operation. So, what were the effects of D9? In all subjects, unpleasant disturbances occurred after taking 1 to 2 tablets, says one of the few surviving reports. Subjects who were previously fresh and rested displayed shaky hands during a brief euphoria, and those who were already tired complained of weak knees and tautness in the muscles. A general paralysis of the central nervous system set in. The desirable euphoria immediately subsided. Decision-making power and intellect were inhibited, energies impaired, the critical faculties diminished, profuse perspiration followed a feeling of hangover, a high degree of fatigue and dejection. This sounds anything but promising, and yet D9 was administered and led to a fiasco for the Navy. 2/3 of Bieber pilots did not survive their daredevil operation. The supposed miracle drug, because of its strong side effects, made combat deployment more difficult rather than easier. It was dropped as swiftly as it had been developed. In the meantime, the German military situation had drastically deteriorated. The Allies had landed on the European continent, and huge forces were advancing toward the western border of the Reich. From autumn 1944, German hopes rested on a new small battle device, again supposedly revolutionary because of its outstanding diving capability, the Seehund, Seal. Hayes' plan was to direct these mini-subs to the Thames estuary and the beaches of Normandy in order to blow up Allied ships. The Seehund's navigation represented an extraordinary challenge, however. Conditions were extremely cramped. Meals were warmed up in a heatable pot, and the crew were obliged to answer the call of nature in empty food tins. Bearing up for 4 days in this combat vessel will be difficult, and not always possible without stimulants, wrote the Navy medical officer, Dr. Hans Joachim Rickert, who was now responsible for treating the Kaver Bande. He seems to have had qualms about using chemical intoxicants to overcome these natural difficulties, when he wrote in a rather detached manner in his war diary, "The military leadership takes the view that in this war, if required, damage as a result of powerful medications must be taken into account." On October 11, 1944, Rickert met the drug designer Orzechowski near Lübeck to talk about a substance that would keep Seehund crews awake and boost their performance. Since preparations combining several hard drugs were largely rejected because of severe side effects, the two men discussed whether high doses of pure cocaine or pure methamphetamine could keep a person awake and efficient for more than 2 days and 2 nights. Time was pressing. 9 days later, on October 20, 1944, Grand Admiral Dönitz visited the small battle flotilla, aware that Hitler was breathing down his neck with his belief in this new miracle weapon. Rickert informed him that the conditions for the submarine Seehund, with a deployment duration of 4 times 24 hours, are difficult and call for the development and testing of new kinds of medication. To avoid a further disaster like the one that had occurred with D9, the decision was made to carry out experiments beforehand, to establish the tolerability and effectiveness of high doses of cocainum hydrochloricum in pill form, high doses of Pervitin in chewing gum, and smaller doses of cocainum hydrochloricum and basicum in chewing gum. But where and on whom should such tests, which were plainly far from hazard-free, be carried out? Connections to the SS, which had been made through Otto Skorzeny, were remembered. Might these open certain strongly secured doors to the Navy? Dönitz gave his okay. Heyer also agreed. The clean-cut Navy men in their neat uniforms again got into contact with the SS, and a secret collaboration began, one that up until today has not been fully studied. In late November 1944, a gate indeed was opened to the naval doctor Rickert, who was to run the experiments. It led to a huge facility, and the steel lettering over the entrance spelled out the words, Arbeit macht frei, meaning, work will set you free. Business trip to the concentration camp. Cold wind blasted over the open space, surrounded by a circular wall 10 feet high, which had flower pots of evergreen plants arranged symmetrically on top. The perimeter was secured with an electric fence, and in front of that were rows of barbed wire and a raked gravel strip. Neutral zone, live ammunition will be fired without warning. Sachsenhausen concentration camp, 21 miles north of Berlin, on the edge of the small town of Oranienburg, was opened in 1936, the year of the Olympic Games. As an equilateral triangle, its architectural concept was based on the principle of total surveillance. From the balustrade of Main Tower A, painted pastel green and partly timbered, a single guard could see the barracks arranged in 4 arches around the semicircular parade ground. A single machine gun could keep all the prisoners covered. Altogether, over 200,000 people from around 40 nations would be confined here until just before the end of the war. Political opponents, Jews, Sinti and Roma, homosexuals, Jehovah's Witnesses, the citizens of occupied European countries, antisocial elements, alcoholics, drug addicts. Tens of thousands of detainees perished from hunger, illness, forced labor, mistreatment, and medical experiments. In the autumn of 1941, an estimated 13,000 to 18,000 Soviet prisoners of war were executed with a shot to the back of the neck in a special facility that was designed to standardize the killing process. One other perfidious specialty of the camp was the so-called shoe-walking unit. Prisoners had to test the resilience of soles for the German shoe industry on uninterrupted forced marches. Companies such as Salamander, Bata, and Leiser sent their latest models to the camp. They were seeking a substitute for leather, which was rationed during the war. The shoe testing ground, parts of which can still be seen today, was a track 2,300 feet long, consisting of 58% concrete road, 10% cinder path, 12% loose sand, 8% mud that was kept constantly under water, 4% chippings, 4% coarsely graveled paths, and 4% cobbles. This was designed to provide a cross-section of all the roads in Europe the German soldiers walked on during their campaigns. The shoe-walking unit was a punishment unit. Anyone who was found guilty of refusing to work, or caught playing cards, bartering, or stealing food from the mess or the kennels, ended up here. Laziness, refusal to obey orders, or even the suspicion of homosexual acts could also lead to referral. To start with, the unit consisted of 120 prisoners, a master cobbler from Sensburg in East Prussia, Dr. Ernst Brennscheid, a career civil servant who never joined the SS or the NSDAP, but who was known for his cruelty, expanded this to 170 prisoners. He increased the daily walking quota to over 25 miles by speeding up the pace. For this marathon, he also made the prisoners carry around rucksacks weighing 25 pounds so that greater stress would be put on the soles. Often he made inmates wear shoes that were too small or ordered different sizes for left and right feet, supposedly to collect additional data. The foreman in charge of the march had a series of numbered cardboard markers at the ready, and as soon as the shoe walkers had performed one round, he put one of these markers in a lead-lined wooden box attached to a pole so that they could be more or less accurately counted. Every 6 miles, shoes were examined to see how worn they were. Prisoners were ordered to lie down, perform knee bends, crawl, or jump on the spot. Often enough, one of the emaciated shoe walkers would collapse. In these instances, Brennscheid would unleash one of his Alsatians. In step, breaking step, or goose stepping, they marched even in bad weather to avoid financial losses. The German Economics Ministry paid for the maintenance costs of the shoe-walking track. The Reich Economics Office controlled the material tests centrally and only allowed leather substitute materials to go into production once they had been successfully tested in Sachsenhausen. It paid the camp 6 Reichsmarks per day per prisoner. In the case of rubber soles, After several improvements, they could withstand 1,800 miles, or a 75-day march. Still, most materials were unusable long before that. Leather fabrics barely survived 600 miles. But a sole made of egalite, a form of soft PVC, survived for over 1,200 miles. All of this was painstakingly noted down. According to estimates, up to 20 people died on the track every day. The SS called this extermination through labor. Pill Patrol. From November 17th to 20th, 1944, the Navy hired the shoe-walking unit for a